This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. If you listen to the music of Destiny's Child, Jay-Z, or Mary J. Blige, you have probably heard the work of Patrick Douthat, who is also known as Ninth Wonder. Easier for me to pronounce. Ninth is a Grammy Award-winning hip-hop producer from Winston-Salem, making his life and livelihood here in Durham right now. And making beats is only part of Ninth's day job. He's also a hip-hop scholar. He's taught at North Carolina Central and Duke University, and most recently Harvard. A new documentary, Hip Hop Fellow, chronicles Ninth's experiences and explores the growing field of hip-hop studies. It premieres at Full Frame Documentary Film Festival next week in Durham. We're going to get a sneak preview on our show today. Ninth Wonder is back on the program. Ninth, good to have you here.
How you doing, sir?
All the better for seeing you. Kenneth Price is the filmmaker. Kenneth, good to see you.
Frank, good to be here.
And welcome back, Duke Professor Mark Anthony Neal, hip-hop scholar and featured in the film as well.
Hello, Mark. Frank, how you doing?
Good to have you here. So let's talk a little bit about this film. Ninth, tell us about, maybe we should get a little bit of your history and how you got started just producing music.
Man, just started as a band geek in the sixth grade, but... You know, it was at the most special time in hip-hop, which we look at as the golden era from 1988 to, like, 95, 96. So that was my adolescent time growing in music, but I kind of carried that over into being a music producer. So a lot of things that I do contains music theory. So I just fell in love with music that way, and, you know, I was getting it in school and at the same time listening to rap records at home. And, you know, I ended up going to college in North Carolina Central, which is right down the street, and, you know, I just... had this notion that I didn't want to work for anybody. I mean, we all work for somebody, but, you know, I didn't want to work for anybody. I really wanted to control my own destiny and really, you know, go about it that way and just live in a work-free, in a happy environment at work. You know what I mean? So I chose production, and I chose my passion, and I started in 2001. And I'm still going.
You are, and you chose your destiny, and Destiny's Child chose you, which all worked out pretty well. Mary
Good,
Blige.
Frank.
Nice job. That's why I'm in my bliss as well. Tell us about working with them, because you also were in the band Little Brother. I remember having you on the show back then, and we're talking about the music and how that band came together, and you kept pulling the whole conversation into music theory, and you were comparing it to jazz, classical, and every time I wanted to talk more about hip-hop, and get my audience hip to that. You were telling them stuff, you know, that they may already be listening to.
Right, exactly.
You were always interested in that.
I was always interested in, you know, just the background, what was going on in the background and how it connected to in a historical text. I was a history major in school, and I always believe in understanding where you come from, where you came from. And in hip-hop, we came from 70s soul and 70s jazz fusion, funk, and all types of music. So that's probably when we first talked. I was always talking about that. Even still, at that time, I didn't really understand what I was leaning towards. I was just something that I loved, you know, and, you know, they turned into teaching.
So then a lot of things have happened since, including this fellowship at Harvard. Tell us how that came about.
Kenneth and I did a documentary called The Wonder Year, which he directed. And Dr. Marcy Morgan, who is the head of the Hip Hop Archive and the Du Bois Institute, well, now known as the Hutchins Center, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Harvard University, asked us to come up to screen the film. And we came up to screen the film in November 2011, I believe. And she pulled me to the side and she said, "You should apply for the fellowship." I said, "What fellowship?" She said, "The Harvard Fellowship, the Du Bois Institute Fellowship." I said, "Wow, you know, I haven't written a paper in a long time, so I took a stab at it." And, you know, I went through the process, and you know, it was a lot of applicants, and there were 15 fellows chosen. And out of those 15 fellows, it was two hip-hop fellows, and I was one of them.
So we've got a clip from the film that Kenneth Price produced and that you showed up there that ended up getting you to the fellowship, and here you are in the classroom.
All of this is, I'm trying to get out of you guys, is how do we decide the standard? What is the standard? What are going to be the rules for being, okay, this is a standard classic hip-hop album. Level of influence, the sound of it. So these are the type of back and forth we're going to get into when we decide what's a classic album that's going to stand the test of time, because we are going to decide that list. Because as you know, when something comes from here, everybody follows. This is the truth. So... if we decided here and put it down and set in stone,
We want this to carry on. Because somebody did it for art. Somebody did it. Somebody said, okay, Picasso is the dude, okay? Maybe a lot of dudes like him, but Picasso is the dude. Dali is the dude. Van Gogh is the dude. These guys are the dudes. So we are here to do the same thing.
There we are. Ninth Wonder from the film Hip Hop Fellow. He is here with us as well as filmmaker Kenneth Price and Mark Anthony Neal, who teaches this kind of thing also in the Academy. And you heard Ninth talk about the importance of standards. And this is what you try to do in the classroom, try to convince not only the class but the world at large that this is a form that has standards and can be taught, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Ninth and I have been fortunate. This is our fourth year teaching a course at Duke, the first three iterations of it, a class called Sampling Soul. And it really was about that kind of 70s funk and jazz and soul music and the way that it was used in hip hop as raw data, but also talking about intellectual property law, talking about, you know, what happens when musical communities, listening communities disperse, you know, because of handheld technology and because of the internet and things of that nature. You know, so it's been a perfect fit, you know, in many ways. It allows us to think about hip-hop studies, and that's definitely the case this semester in the intro to hip-hop studies class that we're teaching, an entry really into African-American studies and African-American history. You know, what we find is that we have a large amount of students who love hip-hop but don't know much about American history or much about African-American history, and hip-hop allows us actually to have these conversations with them.
And Kenneth, you came at this as a fan, as a music fan.
Absolutely.
So that was your entree into the music and into this film. Tell us about it.
So, I mean, I've just been a fan of Ninth for so long. So, being from North Carolina and growing up listening to 90s hip-hop, Little Brother came along, and that was it. It was the best of both worlds. They were from, you know, the area I grew up in, but they also were making this classic-sounding music. And when I found out he was teaching at Ninth, it just so happened I was about ready to start making my thesis film for grad school. And so I reached out to Ninth and thought, hey, do you want to do this thing? What if I follow you around for a year? What are your thoughts? And kind of reluctantly, we kind of reached a point where we started just making the Wonder Year, the first film.
Well, it's interesting to me to think about you as a fan listening to Ninth talk about the theory, because it may or may not have been anything you thought about listening. How did it change for you to take music that you had just enjoyed on its own and start thinking deeply about where this comes from and where it's what the context might be?
I'd always been curious about how Ninth was able to do everything he did. And, you know, I just kind of assumed he was always, like, listening to hip-hop music and all of that. But the fact of the matter is he's listening to all music. So I think that was my biggest takeaway is, you know, his studio is not filled with hip-hop records. It's filled with soul and jazz and old rock records. Like, that's what he's actively listening to incorporate into his music.
And Ninth, you said at one point that you were a little surprised to learn about the R&B and blues roots of hip-hop at a certain point.
Right. I mean, growing up in the South, you know, my mom and dad were avid gospel listeners in the 1970s. And I wasn't introduced into the R&B side of things until my brother is 12 years my senior. He's 50 years old. So, you know, when I was 7, 8 years old, that's when I first got my first taste of R&B music. Right. But then once I got into found my own music was hip hop. And once I got into college, you know, the whole jazz aspect was kind of foreign to me. I saw it on Cosby Show and things like that, but it just wasn't played in my house. And so I didn't understand the connection of the jazz records and the funk records from the 70s and hip hop records in the 90s. And I found it out in the craziest of ways from a friend of mine in college.
How's that?
He stayed next door to me and he played a tape. And on this tape, it was a song called Tidal Wave by Ronnie Laws. And he was a 1975 jazz artist. But I thought it was a song called Who Got the Props by Black Moon. And that was a popular single at the time. And, you know, and I knew it had musicality to it, but I just didn't understand that whole concept, you know. And when I said, man, that's Who Got the Props. I have that. And he's like, nah, this is Ronnie Laws. And it just ended a whole thing of his parents were, you know, affluent, you know, his dad was a doctor and, you know, he had jazz records and things like that. So that just opened a whole nother door to me, you know, as opposed to my mom and dad listened to James Cleveland, right? Mm-hmm. And the Shirley Caesar and people like that. So, you know, that really wasn't in my house, but that was just the beginning of what I call my personal wormhole. That's what it was. And I was like, wow. So if this is being sampled, then what else is it out mm-hmm. there? And I have been on this dig of records for the past 21 years.
Mark Anthony Neal, what what difference does it make? Is it only about a creative genealogy and a lineage about how the music gets put together? You talked about history. Is any of that woven into this kind of this exploration of the samples and where they come from?
Absolutely. I mean, what you have with hip hop is a delving into the sonic archive, right? The sonic archive of American history. You know, this is music that's produced in response to what's happening in the United States, whether it's racial, social, political, et cetera. And hip hop allows you to have a conversation with that history by digging into these sonic archives.
What are some of the things, some of the most surprising findings for you as you sort of explored the wormhole?
Just, I guess just the amount of music that's been used, the amount of music, the amount of records. The amount of soul records and funk records and jazz records and all these types of records between the years of 1972 and 1978, it's about, this is hundreds and thousands of records that has kind of been buried and lost in time, you know, other than the big hits from the 70s. You just got Bob James with a collection of music. So just the amount of music that I found.
And creatively, what does this mean, Mark, in terms of the kind of music that's produced? And I want to talk to you about the sort of the legality of sampling before we get to that, because that was, at one time, a huge critique. Oh, you're taking other people's music. You're not doing anything original.
And that's something we got into really deeply with the sampling soul class, right? You know, what does it mean if you're looking at African-American culture and hip-hop in particular, that's a subculture that really embraces the notion of borrowing and speaking back to each other in the process of that borrowing and creating something new. And then you have intellectual property law, you know, that doesn't recognize any of that. And you could argue that it has stunted some of the creativity of hip-hop, that artists now, producers, don't have really the ability to pull from all these different kinds of art, of raw sources, you know, sonic sources. You know, when you think about Public Enemies, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, which, you know, many folks think of as kind of the crown jewel of a sampling process in terms of all the stuff they draw from, that recording would be financially prohibitive to make in 2014, just simply because you had to pay so much money to get the clearances for it.
Well, this is something that's taken up, too, at Harvard. One of the things that you talk about in the class was understanding the history of these records and from previous generations. Let's listen to this clip. This is Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates talking about that very thing.
The way in which one text responds to, imitates, uses parts of another text and comments upon that previous antecedent text ironically. The popular word for this is sampling. But it wasn't invented by hip-hop people. It's what all literature is about. It's what Western literature is about. The way that they will take a snippet, a formal snippet, and embed it in a new composition. It's a miracle. But so does literature. T.S. Eliot, Herman Melville with Moby Dick. Ulysses by James Joyce is an entire extended riff on the Odyssey by Homer. That's how literature works. It's repetition with a difference. And sampling is just another name for what in literary circles we call intertextuality.
There you go. That's Henry Louis Gates talking about the theory. Of course, Shakespeare famously sampled every one of his plots from somebody else, right? So, but he did good things with it, I'd say. I like the way he worked with the text. So, Kenneth, again, coming as this as a fan, now that's part of your film, does it change the way you listen to the music now as a fan?
A little bit. You know, I mean, it definitely – you meet someone who you've listened to for years and you have certain expectations, and then you begin to develop all these different ideas and expectations about what the music is. But seeing Ninth make beat after beat after beat and just see his process has definitely really made it more enjoyable, because I see how he just goes into another zone when he makes beats. It's really remarkable, and we still kind of work that into this film as well, to see his process, because we thought that was an important process to showcase.
We can't show the whole film here, Ninth, so maybe we can get a shortcut. What is that process? Can you?
Man, it's you know, music, no matter what the genre is, whether it be hip-hop, whether it be jazz, whether it be rock music, it is really a place where a person can enter in his own universe or her own universe. It's a very spiritual place, you know. Some people have their favorite bands or favorite performers, and it does something to them. You know, music, along with math, is really a universal language. But with the music, it creates emotion and it's feeling. So to be able to listen to it will create this particular spiritual enhancement. But to be able to create it and then listen to what you've done is like it's a whole universe within itself.
A universal language, but particular. I mean, there are reasons that there are genres and certain people listen to certain kinds of music.
Exactly.
Because it speaks to them and their history and what they perceive as their context in a particular way. So you have to bring that to it as well, right?
Exactly. Just my love of just beats and drums and the love of melody and chord progression. You know, I was a fan of chord progression even though I was playing the clarinet in sixth grade. Like, just at chord progressions in some types of music makes a person feel good. And just the knowledge of hip-hop, just carrying over into that, I brought all of that into it, not only as a creator but as a fan as well.
And Mark, I know you've been a fan all your life, and this is what's brought you to your scholarship today. So, but is all music produced that way? And that's my question. I mean, Ninth has always, he says, and I, you know, absolutely believe it, he's always brought this kind of deep contextual understanding to the music that he loves. It's not all produced that way, is it? Can it all come from the ground up, just a feeling that you have without ever thinking about a chord progression?
I think some of it does occur in that context. I mean, some folks are going to be trained, right? Some people are going to be natural in terms of playing musicians and natural musicality, you know, but some folks are trained in this, right? And the disconnect is that very often when we think about hip hop and rap music in particular, we don't think this is coming from folks who have musical training. Right. And the reality is that, you know, a fair amount of folks, I mean, that great, you know, day in September when J. Cole and Fonte and Ninth Wonder dropped an album, you know, what you saw celebrated on that day was the musical history of North Carolina. Right. You could hear the marching bands. Right. You could hear the step teams. Right. All that history, you know, which made, you know, which makes North Carolina hip hop unique in that same way.
You know, I made a joke on that show about 10 years ago when you first, because what happened was your record debuted on MTV back when they were actually playing music.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we had you on the show, and I said something like, well, you know, there's West Coast rap and there's East Coast. Will there ever be a day where there's Piedmont rap? And it was kind of funny at the time, but what you're saying now is, yes, there is. Of course there is, in a way.
Yeah, it's definitely, we call ourselves, you know, lack of a better term, we're in the Middle East. We're in the middle part of the Eastern East Coast. That's what we are. You know, we had this conversation yesterday in class about what is South and where is South and what's your idea of being from the South. But our sound was different. Our sound, J. Cole sound, you know, was very different. It had hints of up north, you know, in the style of beats, but in the South it had our twang in the way we talked. Mm. And I guess that is where it came from. That's what our particular sound is, a melting pot of sorts.
Well, and this gets back to that universal in the particular, right? I mean, that's what regional writing is all about. Everybody, people from Minnesota read Southern writers because they want to feel that particular, but there's something that registers with each of them, wherever you're from.
And you know, and the best artists are able to, we talked about this last night, you know, be able to mask what their influences are. You know, a significant amount of hip-hop artists who have Caribbean roots who have somehow managed to, you know, present themselves as just being from New York as if they don't have family and legacy in Trinidad, Tobago, or Jamaica, or any number of places. I mean, you see the same thing in terms of Southern hip-hoppers, right? But when you listen to Jay-Z, for instance, and when he's riffing on a song like Big Pimpin' or Poppin' Tags, you hear how comfortably he fits into a Southern musical landscape.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about the film Hip Hop Fellow in the field of hip hop studies. Producer Ninth Wonder is with us, Duke Professor Mark Anthony Neal, filmmaker Kenneth Price. We're going to talk more about this just ahead on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking about the documentary Hip Hop Fellow makes its world premiere at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, which is next weekend here in Durham. Film follows hip hop producer Ninth Wonder through a fellowship at Harvard University, documents the study of hip hop in the classroom. We've been talking with Ninth Wonder, Duke Professor Mark Anthony Neal, and the film's producer, Kenneth Price. So, Kenneth, I'm wondering sort of what you learned about the music as you went through and actually did this, again, starting out as a fan, and now you're learning about more about the music in depth.
I think students can look at it and really look more in depth of the music. So we're used to just listening to hip hop, and obviously it's this very popular art form, but it's been very understudied up to this point. And I think that's beginning to change. And I hopefully this film is maybe part of that change, the more people who are able to see it. But people don't think about what the music's based on. And, you know, Dr. Neil talks about how it's based off of the civil rights movement. And it's based off of soul music and how that's influenced hip hop. And now it's influencing another generation of people making that music. So I think moving forward, you know, the goal is it's taught in every university just the same way as a jazz studies courses or a classical studies courses.
Mark, is it taught in every university now?
Just about every elite university is offering some sort of hip-hop class, right? And it's an interesting dynamic because on one hand, I think it's the elite institutions that have the resources, you know, whether it's Ninth teaching at Harvard or at Duke, someone like Bun B teaching with Anthony Penn down at Rice, you know, Questlove, the class he does at NYU. It's always going to be those kind of high profile classes. You know, it's been a little much more of a struggle, for instance, trying to get these classes embedded at HBCUs, you know, whether that we're talking here locally or nationally. That, you know, part of the difficulty around hip hop studies is that it's to do this work, you get hit from both sides. You know, on the one hand, there are the artists and practitioners, you know, who are skeptical of who's in the classroom. And then you have the traditional academics who are skeptical about what's being taught in the classroom. You know, what makes Ninth such a great figure is that here's someone who's a practitioner who in another iteration would have been a history professor. Right. So he is bringing a certain kind of pedagogical science to the process while also, you know, drawing on his rich knowledge of the archive, but also doing this, you know, as a practitioner also.
Well, Ninth, how much pressure do you feel to bring legitimacy? I mean, that's sort of what happened to sociology, right? We want to study how people live together, and then they had to put a lot of numbers on it to make it legitimate in the academy. So it became a lot about math and a little less about people. Do you feel a pressure to sort of make this thing appeal? Is there a way in which you struggle to keep this an art form and still make it legitimate in the academy?
Well, I think you can keep it an art form enough if you keep money away from it.
So there's no money in hip hop? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
But, you know, it's definitely a situation of I had to make sure that I'm entering in a space of academia. Right. And academia is so based on the fact of what degrees that you have and how many books have you written and things like that. And even when I apply for the Harvard Fellowship, one of the questions is, or one of the requirements is that you have to have 5 years of hip hop experience.
Well, you got that.
And I've got that. So, you know, we're kind of rewriting the book here.
Yeah.
We're kind of in the same space as sociology was in. We're kind of making what is a hip hop PhD? Who are the scholars in this? Did we get a degree from an institution or did we get a degree from the culture? Like what is that? And we're kind of creating it as we go along. So that was, you know, working under Skip Gates and working under Dr. Marcy Morgan and working beside this gentleman right here, you got to get your chops up. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I had to pull a lot of things I learned from high school and even college to really make this thing take form.
Mark, you talked about practitioners being a little worried about who is in the classroom. What do you mean?
For real. I mean, particularly the old guard who feels, you know, who have a legitimate gripe that there are people eating off of hip hop in ways that they have never been able to eat off of hip hop. You know, if this was a different cultural form, if we were talking about film, if we were talking about literature, there would be endowed professorships for Afrika Bambaataa, for, you know, for Run DMC, for any number of these folks, you know, a long time ago. You know, Roxy Shante would have an endowed professorship someplace. Hip hop has not been able to take care of its own in that same way. And so, you know, they look and they see scholars who they wonder what kind of relationship they have to the culture. And that's a legitimate question. And it's like, well, what do you know about hip hop?
Right.
Right. You know, I always get protected because I get to say, well, I was there. Right. But not everybody gets to say, have that kind of narrative response. Right. And they don't necessarily need to. Right. No one who teaches Shakespeare, you know, can make the argument. I was there. Right. What we want are people who are immersed enough in the culture to understand the dynamics of it that are authentic in their relationship to the culture, right? And that goes on both sides, both in terms of the scholar, but also in terms of the scholar practitioner.
I actually had a Shakespeare professor who was there. I swear it. I swear it. So let's get a little one-on-one. I'd like to get a sense of what goes on in the classroom and what it is you teach. So I know that Illmatic, of course, is one of the albums that you Nas's Illmatic is one of the things that you teach off of. It's a seminal album. Let's hear a clip from that and then get a sense from you what how this would be part of a class.
It's yours. Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
It's yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine. It's mine, it's mine. Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine.
I sip the dumb peak, watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes. All the words past the margin. The whole of mic, I'm throbbing. Mechanical movement, understandable smooth. That murderers move with the thief's theme. The thief's play theme. Me at night, they won't act right. The fiend of hip hop has got me stuck like a crack pipe. The mind activation, react like I'm facing time like Pappy Mason. With pins I'm embracing, wipe the sweat off my dome, spit the phlegm on the streets. Sway Tim's on my beats, makes my cipher complete.
Illmatic, just that song, The World Is Yours. Let's just take that song for a second. That song contains so much information. Who are the players? You have Nasir Jones and Peter Phillips. Nas being from Queens, Pete being from Mount Vernon, New York, Pete having West Indian background. Nas' dad was a jazz performer. The World Is Yours is a playoff of Scarface, the movie. It's used the Ahmad Jamal sample. The beat machine Pete used for this beat was an SP-1200. That's a thesis in itself. Just this one song contains so much information. The technology was used, where the players are from, the words that Nas used in the song, all of those are just... So we use that as not only from a technological standpoint, but from a historical standpoint too, because we're dealing with a generation of kids who think the 1960s and the 70s is 100 years ago. So what better way to get them to understand jazz, what better way to get them to understand what was going on in the 70s from a political standpoint, what happened to Queens, what happened to the Bronx, what happened to these places where Nas is talking about looking out his window. What better way to get them to understand it is through music and these time capsules. Each song is a time capsule. And that's the best way to get these kids into it. It's just that it's saying you're supposed to know what Truman did. You're supposed to know what LBJ did. You're supposed to know what Nixon did. And you're supposed to know what Malcolm X did. What better way to get them to understand these ideas but through music that borrowed from that time?
Right. And you can hear a reflection of sort of what the response was at that time, and now you can respond to that because, as you've said and others, it's a conversation. It's an ongoing conversation.
Right.
So the way Nas felt about it when that album was produced, the way you feel about that now looking back is somewhat different. And the way the original art, not even original, but some of the sampled artists might have, with the milieu and the context they were living in when they produced their original hits.
Exactly.
That's all part of it. So, and the technology is interesting too, Mark, because one of the things we've heard about hip hop is that it's disposable. You know, it's a one hit wonder, it's up and it's down. But this does have a genealogy and it does get carried forward. It carries all sorts of genealogical and genetic information.
And more so now than ever before. I mean, because of YouTube, you know, the ability of any young person to be able to literally go to this archive that has never existed before and not only to be able to pull on a hip-hop song that came out in 1993, but that original sample, right? They can go find Ronnie Lawson's Tidal Wave from 1975 and unpack a whole history about that era of jazz with the Grover Washingtons and the Donald Byrds and what the relationship was to that form of jazz to black communities, right? You know, it was the kind of jazz that was still in black communities, right? You know, black folks weren't necessarily, as a community, invested in avant-garde jazz, right? But this kind of everyday jazz that you would hear at a house party or you would hear at a club, it's not surprising that hip-hop draws upon that particular legacy.
Do they do that when your students, when you expose these contextual elements, ninth, to your students, do they get interested? Do they take off? Do they want to go off and find the various roots of these songs?
They want to go off and find the various roots of it because they just don't understand the depth of it.
Yeah.
It's like an abyss for them. You know, you give them you know, we give these students an album to dissect, you know, and people think that hip hop is very empty and, you know, lack of genius. But once they get into digging into these records, they find mountains and mountains of information, and they come back the next week saying, this is killing me, man. Like, I did not know that this particular album, like Illmatic, had so much in-depth into it until I started to search by the backstories and everything. So, you know, that's what usually happens to a student. And now, you know, coming up in April, Illmatic is a 20-year-old album.
Wow. Wow. So that's got a history, too. And
exactly.
I'm sure it's been much sampled and much reprised. Has it? Is it something that people have gone back to themselves, other artists?
You know, that's kind of the staple. That's kind of the staple of most solo artists, most lyricists, MCs. That's like the holy grail of albums. It was 39 minutes and 43 seconds long. It only had 10 tracks on it. That was one guest feature. It was a great host of producers on this album who are all legends now. And so that is kind of the album that people chase. If your album is compared to Illmatic, like this particular generation believes that, and I understand it, The Good Kid, Mad City by Kendrick Lamar is the Illmatic of this generation because it told a story of a kid looking through the eyes of other people. And so that's what it is. So a lot of young artists now look at that as the holy grail and as the benchmark for albums.
Yeah. Another.
Hell, even. I mean, Nas himself has been chasing. I mean, it was his first recording, right? Right. Somewhere he's been chasing it for 20 years himself.
Well, let's talk about another album that I know you use in your class. We'll play this clip from Award 2, A Tribe Called Quest. Let's listen. Tribe Called Quest Award Tour on their album Midnight Mirage. A lot going on in that song as well.
A lot going on. There's at least, I had a student remake that particular beat in class using Ableton Live, and that song has at least 4 layered samples into it. So it took them a while to find, you know, where it was. And, you know, and we challenged them to go to the record stores. Not to go online, to go to the record stores to find the pieces of vinyl that, you know. So it was kind of like an archaeological dig almost. But that particular song itself has a lot of contained information. It's 3 members of Tribe Called Quest. They're on Jive Zomba. Zomba was a record label started in South Africa, which moved to London, which ended up moving, became a part of Jive, which was a real, one of the biggest reasons why Tribe was connected to Zomba Records. And so just all of that was pulled out of that one song. And it was Midnight Marauders was Tribe's 3rd album, 3rd release, which also came out 21 years ago.
You are now, I believe, on an impossible quest. You've got a project going.
Yes.
So what is it, top 200?
I am commissioned by the Harvard University Library to create the standard and creating the top 200 hip-hop albums of all time.
You're going to get into a fight.
I am. I'm prepared for that
fight.
How
do you do that? How do you do that?
You know, there's certain criteria. I definitely have people that I call on. Yeah. This brother sitting next to me, Dr. Mark Anthony Neal, young guru. My brother Fonte from formerly Little Brother and now Foreign Exchange. So many people that I've asked, different people from different regions. Domino, who is the head of Hyrule from the Bay Area. Just influence, level of influence, what did it mean to the people at the time? Does it stand the test of time? It's not about album sales
much. I was going to ask you, what are the criteria? What are you looking for?
You know, just those things, level of influence, the production, the sound, what it did for the region, you know.
How do you measure that? Let's stop there. What it did for the region.
What it did for the region.
Yeah.
Well, you have, let's take for the region Memphis, Tennessee. And you have, you know, you have A-Ball MJG, and you have 3-6 Mafia, and you have Project Pat. These are classic artists, not only nationally, but they mean so much to Memphis, Tennessee, that they put out classic albums, and you have to put that on the list. New Orleans has it. Houston has it. The Bay Area has it. And Oakland, they have it. So of course, Los Angeles, Seattle. We have it in North Carolina.
North Carolina has it.
And the hub of it all, even in Miami with Luke and Two Live Crew. But the hub of it all is New York City, where majority of the albums will come from. But we have everybody from, I have everybody on that list from Nelly's Country Grammar, which was very, very instrumental in the Midwest hip hop, all the way down to the most critical of things and the most critically acclaimed, J-Lib. And Mad Villain and Danny Automator and Kool Keith. Those are landmark albums as well. So we have to put all of those on the same list.
When you get the list put together, we'll have you back.
Okay.
I want to thank you all. Hip hop producer and artist Patrick Douthat, known as Ninth Wonder. Thank you. Duke Professor of African and African American Studies Mark Anthony Neal, and the director of the film Hip Hop Fellow Kenneth Price. It premieres at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. It gets underway in Durham next week. Thank all of you for being on the program. Good to have you here. And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.